right, episode 23. Joined right now by New York Times bestselling author Jeff Perlman. He's a jungle frequent guest in the jungle. He's written Gunslinger about Brett Favre and his most recent book coming out tomorrow, Football for a Buck. Thanks for coming on, Jeff. I really fucking appreciate it, man.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. So most of my audience, which is pretty marginal, but there is some, are derivatives of the Jim Rome Show, which is where I first came to know you. Mm-hmm. So any plans to hop on Rome in the near future to promote the book?
Yeah, I think I'm going in next week.
Oh, nice, man. Next week. Cool. Yeah. Looking forward to that.
Jim is the reason I moved to California. Literally, Jim is the reason I moved to California.
Really?
Yep, that's a true story.
That's awesome. Right on. Well, I'll hop right into the football for a buck because I got a few questions that I want to get to, and some of them are actually from your own podcast, which I heard with your wife, and I heard a couple anecdotes on there, and I wanted to just kind of maybe expand on those. But first, we'll start off with you in high school. You basically fell in love with the USFL when you were a kid, and you wanted to do a report on the USFL, correct?
That is correct.
Nice. And basically what I got a kick out of was you saying you called the phone line in 1990 after the league had folded for a number of years and just kept leaving messages.
Yeah.
No, I got a kick out of that.
I was like, I was too dumb to know that nobody was going to call me that. You know, I was like, ooh, maybe they'll call back, and I'm leaving these messages. Hi, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm a senior Mailback High School, and I'm really fascinated by, like, even if the USFL were operating in full, nobody's calling me back. But the fact that it's like someone's like answering machine in a basement in like Tacoma.
You gotta totally respect the hustle though as a kid. Like that's
thanks.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cause I know like your reputation now is that you hustle on the interview process for your books, and that's why they're so in depth. So what was it like researching for this book? Were you getting people kind of opening up right away, or was there like a little bit of a barrier when people are like, "You're calling about the USFL"?
No, there was. I've never had less of a barrier because you know, it's interesting. If you write a book about a team, let's just say, for example, there might be people still affiliated with the team who are reluctant to talk about. You know, Brett Favre is a good example. I think Brett Favre's biography. Well, Brett Favre is so current that there are people still loyal to the Packers, or people still loyal to Brett Favre. And that causes a little bit of, you know, think before you sort of talk. But there is no USFL. They haven't been around for 20 years.
Right.
There's nothing to be related to. There's no team to be related to. It's really equivalent to sort of an old fraternity, you know, 30 years ago. And the brothers have all moved on, so you don't have to worry about pissing them off and then making you, you know, drink a keg of cow urine. You know, like, you're gone, and it's your memory. So for these guys, there was no reluctance. It was the most open I've ever had subjects be about a book.
Interesting. Okay. And like a lot of people, if anybody followed the USFL, like they had players like Steve Young, Herschel Walker, but in your research, did you come across any players that maybe would have been legends in the NFL, but they only really existed in the USFL world?
That's interesting. There was one guy who I loved, and I think he would have been a really good NFL player. His name was Fred Bassana. He was a quarterback for the Oakland Invaders.
Oh, yeah.
And Fred, he played in some like beer league in California. That's where they found him. And he was a nobody. He played a cow, but he was a backup. He had a trial with the Bills, trial with the Giants, never made it. And the coach in Oakland was John Ralston, who coached at Stanford, so he knew him from the Pac-10 or whatever it was at Pac-8. And he called him in, and Bassana was kind of done with football. He was trying to be a teacher. He's like, just give it one more try, Freddie. And, you know, Fred Bassana comes in. He's, I would say, top five USFL quarterback. You know, he wasn't Jim Kelly, but he was really, really good. He never got a chance in the NFL, but I think he would have been a very serviceable NFL player. Not a legend, but a very serviceable NFL player.
Interesting. Cool. I always kind of like guys like that. Like, I'm obviously Canadian up here in Vancouver, and, like, there's guys kind of who play in some pro leagues throughout Europe and whatnot that never got a shot in the NHL, and, like, you always wonder, you know, if you got their crack, if they'd at least be able to hang. So
yeah, that was kind of the beauty of the USFL, that it was like you said about those leagues, it's guys who maybe they were a little bit too small, or I mean, to me, the classic USFL story is Sam Mills, who went on to become a really legendary NFL linebacker. time when he joined the USFL. He'd been cut in the Canadian League by Toronto, been cut by the Cleveland Browns. He played at Division III Montclair State. He was a 5'9" middle linebacker. Everyone looked at him and thought he couldn't play because he was so small.
Sure.
And he played in the USFL. He was probably the best player in the league. Signed by the New Orleans Saints, taken, brought there by Jim Moran, who's coaching the Spouse.
Oh, yeah.
And he became a legend, you know? He became a legend.
5'9 linebacker. That's just like, I'm.
Yeah,
you know,
middle linebacker. 5'9 middle linebacker.
Yeah, incredible. As we sit here watching the Monday Nighter or this one or the one following, and you think about 5'9 running around out there, that's wild.
It's crazy.
Yeah, man. So, So you. You kind of you mentioned on your own podcast that you kind of wrote Gunslinger as almost an in to getting into writing football for a buck, you know, kind of like to right. So you could use them as a package deal. But then you also mentioned that you ended up loving doing that book. So I was just wondering if you could kind of expand on how that kind of process unfolded from it being like your foot in the door to a project that you fell in love with.
Well, all these projects that. What makes or breaks them is sort of the bonds you form with people. Mm-hmm. They're mostly temporary bonds, you know, you don't stay in touch with someone, certainly, you know, for that long, every now and then you do. But I really became very attached to Brett Favre's family. Which is funny because he didn't help me with the book, but his family did. And his mom was fantastic, and his sister was great. And, you know, his nephew Dylan, who played quarterback in college, I still love the guy. So I just really found the family very warm. I found Mississippi very warm. There are parts of Mississippi, obviously, that have a horrible racist history.
Sure.
They're also very warm people there. And the Favre family was amazing. So that really made it. When you go down and they're like, is that talking to you? No. All right, what do you want to know? Like, that's a rare kind of thing, you know, precious gem. So I loved it. I really did. It was such a fun book to write.
Was there any contact in the last few years with the family at all? Or, like you say, was it just one of those kind of in-the-moment relationships?
No, I always check in. No, Brett Favre's mom, Benita, is the best. I check in on her every now and then. That's just feeling.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, no, totally. That's totally. Awesome. I'm still, his nephew Dylan and his wife, Bree, I mean, I consider them good friends, actually. So I love when that happens.
Very cool. Okay, so that book obviously was successful and a great book, and then so that opened the door to the book Football for a Buck, which is coming out tomorrow, and that has some funny correlations because when you started, or I guess when you had the idea to write the book, Donald Trump was still just kind of Donald Trump reality show guy, and then as the process is unfolding of writing the book, he lo and behold becomes president of the United States. So
yeah, that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's a little digression on my part, but I never really bought Elon Musk's simulation theory of our world until he became president, and then I kind of looked up. I was like, maybe somebody's fucking with us.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but anyway, back to that. So Trump, so that was kind of unfolding as you're working on this book, I imagine. What was that like as far as like his character in the book and then kind of watching the real life story of Donald Trump unfold as far as the presidential thing?
I'll be totally blunt with you. I wanted to scream and punch someone because I'm researching who this guy is, and he's the exact same guy he was 30 years ago. And he pulled this same exact con, just on a smaller scale, on these USFL owners. So I'm reading it, I'm researching it, I'm talking to people, they're describing the exact same things he's doing now, except on a bigger scale. The promises, the nonsense, the bullshit, just all this stuff that it's, I can't even explain to you the craziness of researching a book and having it happen in real time, just on a bigger stage. I've never experienced anything like that in my life. It was the weirdest thing ever. Really was the weirdest thing ever. He kept wanting to explain to people, don't you understand? I kept saying to my wife, why isn't Hillary Clinton bringing up the USFL? And I'm not saying it would have been a smart strategy, because I think it's too many levels, too many things you have to explain, but it was a direct parallel to his behavior, and he ruined that lead. You know, and he's just like, he's ruining so many things now. This is unbelievable to me. I can't believe this guy's president. And if you know as much as I do about the USFL, you would never, even if you loved all his policies, you would never vote for him because you wouldn't trust him. I wouldn't trust that guy to watch my wallet. I literally would not trust him. If I left a room with my wallet, I would come back and tell my money. That is someone I trust.
Yeah, I like that. And did you feel like you were kind of looking behind the curtain at like this bad shit that was unfolding that nobody else seemed to, or at least I'm sure other people did, but like a lot of people seem to be missing this bigger picture that you kind of had an inside view of.
Oh yeah, and you also, it's like you saw the power of a con man. Like I saw the power. There are people, he ruined the USFL. There were people who fell for his stuff and were voting for him. Well, I don't like Hillary. No, hey, this is the con man who ruined your football league. Yeah, well, you know, like that's some powerful stuff when you can totally screw someone over and still get their vote in the presidential election. I mean, yeah,
it's fascinating.
It's crazy
watching it from like Vancouver's maybe 15 minutes from the border if you drive fast. So like I'm not that far, but watching it from the border removed, it's fascinating. Really watching all that's unfolding and the contrast between now and 10 years ago and all that's happened in between. It's really I'm just fascinated and kind of in awe.
The good news is he says climate change doesn't exist and he's going to be able to fix the drought where I live in California. So
perfect. We can all relax then.
Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah, perfect. Good. That's great news. That's, you know, I'm glad he overruled all the scientists in the world. But so there's a guy, Pacific Northwest here, Boston College alumnus, who is near and dear to many people in my neck of the woods, Doug Flutie. And basically what I got out of kind of little snippets here and there is he was basically using Doug Flutie as the Mexico Wall when he was with the USFL. Basically saying he was gonna sign him to this massive contract and make other people pay for it. Is that kind of how it went?
Yeah, that is exactly how it went. He gave Doug Flutie the biggest contract in football history, told his general partners that the other owners in the league would pay for it. I'm going to sign him, but they'll pay for it. Signs Doug Flutie, tells the other owners they're going to pay for it. The other owners collectively say, no fucking way, and they don't pay for it.
Right.
It's the exact same thing. It's funny, I was on MSNBC the other day, and the host, Alex Witt, said, that kind of sounds like the Mexico Wall. And instinctively, I said, it is the Mexico Wall. Like, it actually is the Mexico Wall, except Doug Flutie took a 5'9" quarterback instead of the wall. Same exact tactic. That's his prologue with this guy. Everything he said 30 years ago, he does now.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's bizarre to me that one could even try and sell the concept of signing a player and having other owners pay for it. Like, and the fact that somehow...
insane. Yeah. Wait, and here's the craziest thing of all. It was all, everything he used to justify it was a lie. He was like, he wrote this letter, he was like, it is paying huge dividends, as everyone can see, it's paying huge dividends. No, it wasn't. Big play, New Jersey Generals Birmingham Stallions opened up in Birmingham in 1984, the year before Flutie signed, and drew 60,000. They opened up again there. The year Flutie was on the team, they drew 36,000. The reason is because the fans started losing interest when they knew that Flutie was going to move to fall. And he moved them to fall. Donald freaking Trump. There were no tangible markers of success from the Doug Flutie signing. Not a single one.
Huh. And you say the reason that that he wanted to move the schedule to the fall was because he was pissed that he didn't get an in with the NFL?
He wanted an NFL team.
Yeah.
He wanted an NFL team. He saw that as a one route. It was going to be a merger with the NFL. It's crazy. It's really crazy.
So his end game was a merger, basically? Like he kind of wanted
his end game was one way or another getting an NFL team, whether it was a merger, whether it was a lawsuit and a forced sort of merger, whether it was whatever it had to be. He had in his head that one way or another, he thought the NFL was going to settle, that they were going to sue, the NFL would settle. Part of the settlement would be the absorption of a couple of teams. That's what he saw happen. And he would take the Generals and put them in Manhattan because the Jets had left for Queens 2 years earlier.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So do you think like any of that past history has anything to do with his treatment of the NFL present day?
100%.
Yeah?
He, the whole patriotism thing and the kneeling and the Kaepernick, it's all nonsense. When he was an owner, he would sit during the national anthem. He would do work during the anthem.
Right.
Factually, it's all nonsense. He tried buying the Baltimore Colts and failed. He tried buying the Buffalo Bills and failed. He made a weak effort to go to the Dallas Cowboys and failed. He led the loss and failed. The guy is nothing but antagonism toward the NFL in the last few years. It's all nonsense. He didn't care. I mean, I hate to get on this thing, but like, Mr. Patriot, right?
Right.
You spent 5 years insisting you had proof that the sitting president of the United States was a Kenyan-born Muslim. You have 5 military deferments.
Yeah.
You mocked John McCain for his time as a POW. Mr. Patriot? Are you joking? Like, are you joking?
Right.
I don't even know how we got here. I don't know how we got here.
All right. So, yeah, man, I'll let you go pretty quickly, but a couple last questions.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
No, I appreciate it, man. I genuinely looking forward to this book. I think the subject matter is underutilized. It's such an interesting time in sports. And so the last question basically is, how did Rome get you to move to L.A.?
So basically I was doing Jim when he had his CBS TV show, Sports Network. Jim, he would always have two panelists on.
Sure.
And I was one of them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept coming out, really loved it. And started bugging my wife. I said, we should move to California. No. Or she came up with me on a Rome trip. And she went to like Balboa Island and walked around and just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, one day she's like, okay, that is all because of Jim Rome. Without Jim Rome, we do not move.
Perfect. I like it. Yeah, so because basically I just have this show because of Jim Rome, and I've been listening to him for about a decade and a half now, and it became kind of a hobby of mine, and people like you stepping up and coming on, man, it means a hell of a lot to me, and I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for doing it, man.